From KUAZ, Arizona Public Media, I'm Mark McLemore, and this is the annual Haunted Halloween edition of Arizona Spotlight. We've got a lot of Halloween treats and maybe a few tricks coming up in the next half hour. Be warned, this program is not intended for the faint of heart. Light up the jack-o'-lantern and gather round the radio, because the chills are about to begin here on Arizona Spotlight. It may be a good thing that Centennial Hall doesn't have a chandelier hanging in its theater, because some say they do have a phantom that lurks backstage.
The ghost light is on at Centennial Hall. Is it there to keep people from tripping while walking across the darkened stage at night? Or is it really there for the ghosts? That's right. Centennial Hall has its share of spirits, according to Mario DeVetta with UA Presents.
Most of the ghosts, I believe, are actually in this room, in the main auditorium for Centennial Hall. It's home to actually two ghosts. One is apparently a young Spanish man from the colonial period of Tucson's history and is dressed entirely in black, and former employees have seen them as has custodial staff. And there's also a female ghost that prefers kind of a classic long billowy dress of the 1890s.
If you like the dark corners of the balcony at Centennial Hall, that's where you may meet the lady.
She's apparently been up in the very, very top of the balcony, and she's been seen crying. And there's also been reports that up there they've heard kind of hoarse whinnying noises from one of the males, actually, that frequents the theater.
The spirits of Centennial Hall seem harmless enough, but Mario says they do go bump in the night.
There's a basketball court actually kind of on stage backstage, and some of the stagehands will at times, during a show, will play backstage while they're setting up a show. And at night they've seen the basketball kind of dribbling itself on the stage, and no one else is playing it, and which, you know, is something that has happened and I think would kind of creep me out.
And while that specter may more correctly belong over at the McHale Center, the hall also has the spirit of performance, literally.
There are reports, and this could be probably backstage as well, that the piano has been seen, you know, playing itself. Now, I don't know if that's exhaustion at 2 a.m. in the morning or if that's someone actually seeing the keys moving at 1 or 2 in the morning, because there are a couple of pianos that we have backstage, one kind of on stage that's off to the side, and then we also have one in the green room that some, I guess, ghosts like to prefer.
Most of the reports of the unexplained come from the crews that work overnight at Centennial Hall. Mario admits he makes sure he's gone by 10 p.m. He has no desire to meet the spectral residents of the hall, though he doesn't necessarily want the residents of the spirit world to leave either.
Every good theater has its ghost story, so we're very proud of our ghosts because it shows that we have a theater that people want to stay in forever.
For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Christopher Conover.
On one very special night, each October for the last 4 years, downtown Tucson is overrun by a legion of gruesome zombies. Ordinary people from all walks of life find themselves transformed into an army of the undead, and it's all for a good cause. Matt Felix was brave enough to venture the dangers of Zombie Walk 2009, and he brought back this audio postcard.
I'm Amy.
I'm Jean-Pierre.
I'm a dead goth girl.
And I'm a zombie Jughead from the Archie comics. I've got my hand burger, because Jughead loves his burgers.
Well, I was in the bathroom, throwing blood everywhere, plastering toilet paper and latex on my face. As artfully disheveled.
Oh, I'm Justice Pee Wee Herman. Oh, come on. There's two types of people in the world. Those who have a zombie plan and those who will be zombies, so.
We love zombies.
We're zombie movie freaks. This year I think it's big, probably because people really need to have fun. This is one way to let out stress and be gross and have it socially acceptable, because you can't act like this at work.
Plus it's just fun.
I just like the zombie walk. This is the third one that I've been to, and they're a lot of fun. Zombies kind of represent, or the undead apocalypse represents the overall breakdown of society. You know, the undead and all their thousands and millions are the people that have lost everything because of social chaos. Any individual one is almost powerless, but in their thousands swarming like locusts, they're an overwhelming force. And if you spend too much time with them, you might become one. And so zombies represent middle-class fears of poverty.
They have a weird draw that just makes them fun because they're, you know, brains and blood.
It's one of those old horror movie traditions. It's been around almost as long as horror movies have been, horror stories. And it's one of those scary things you can think about. No one believes it's possible, but imagine, you know, you bury someone who's dead, like a loved one. You expect them to stay dead, but then they get up and walk around and want to hurt you, eat you. That's frightening as hell.
They're good dancers.
They're excellent dancers.
They're very attractive, too.
Of the supernatural world, I feel like they're probably the best dancers.
I think so, too.
Yeah.
What is it about brains, do you think, that makes them go crazy?
I guess the consumption of one's metaphysical self.
Purely delicious, that's why.
Knowledge is power.
It's a good texture.
Brains are good because it's like a noodle all bunched together, so yeah. When you start slurping, you just get the whole thing.
It kind of like comes undone.
It's squishy.
Who's cooler, zombies or vampires?
Werewolves.
Well, the Zombie Walk is actually a charity event. We're not really affiliated with anybody. It's just a bunch of the local zombies that decide to crawl out of their graves once a year and have some fun. We've decided to choose the Community Food Bank as our charity because it's easy to raise funds and food for those in need, and, you know, brains for grains type of thing.
Brains! Brains!
Voices, Community Stories Past and Present, Inc. is a nonprofit group that gives Tucson youth a chance to tell their own stories in their own words. Next, Christina Lopez tells us about her encounter with a figure that looms large in Latin folklore, La Llorona, the Weeping Woman. She's said to prey on children who have lost their way, and that perfectly describes what happened to Christina one dark and moonless night along the Santa Cruz River.
There's a legend I heard growing up about a woman who drowned her children in the Santa Cruz River over a man who then left her anyways for another woman. And feeling remorse, the woman went back to the Santa Cruz River searching and searching for her washed away children. She then drowned herself, and to this day, anyone and everyone who steps into the Santa Cruz River can hear her calling and crying for her children. About 2 summers ago, I went out with some friends to a party. I found myself stranded. I didn't have a ride, a phone, to reach anybody, nothing. So I didn't know what else to do. I just decided to start walking in the Ajo Wash. The Ajo Wash led to the Santa Cruz River. My feet were cold. I was barefoot. My hair was dripping with sweat. And I was really scared. It was dark. It was laid out. And all I could think of was the legend I heard growing up. Pulling my way through the grass and trees, my face was full of tears. And I was so nervous because growing up, hearing that story, it just made me scared. And I was trying as hard as I can to get out of the river, but it seemed so long, like such a long walk. My feet were getting numb from all the rocks I had stepped on, the stickers. I looked all around me, and I felt her presence. Like, I could almost feel her breath against the back of my neck. My hair stood up. It was pitch black that night, like pitch black. It was dark when I was first walking in the river, when I found myself in the river. Every which way I turned to look, I like seeing white, just a white figure in the distance. I guess I thought so hard about it that I could like almost hear her voice, her cries, her wailing. I'm almost 100% sure that she was there. And I always thought of La Llorona as, like, just a regular legend. But that night, it felt real. There's stories you hear from your parents, and you believe them. You believe in Santa Claus. You believe in the Easter Bunny and the Tooth Fairy. Anything your parents tell you, you just believe, you believe, you believe. And for kids, it's really scary to hear that kind of thing when you're living so close to the river that way. Like, and me, like, I was alone. There was nobody there to just be like, just calm down, Christina. Like, there's no ghost haunting the river. The sun was coming up, and I finally got out of the river. I made my way to my Nana's house, but just the way I felt was, like, unforgettable and traumatizing, because I never want to go back to the Santa Cruz River. Day or night, it doesn't matter. It scares me.
Stay tuned, if you dare, for more of this haunting Halloween edition from Arizona Spotlight, right after this break. Welcome back to Arizona Spotlight. For serious movie scares, nothing can truly compete with silent horror movies. They're like flickering images captured from a nightmare with a quiet power all their own. I talked with film historian and U of A professor, Dr. David Soren, about some of the greatest silent movie monsters and how these films of a bygone era retain their power to thrill even today.
It's a very different experience from the sound film. Some people hate it, but some people try a few and then get hooked. And then you find that these silent films, particularly the silent horror films, are a different world, and they are artistically quite fascinating. They involve quite a number of art movements which are still being used today.
Let's start with Nosferatu.
Well, Nosferatu, we're fortunate to see that at all, because Nosferatu was basically a vampire film. Vampire films are very hot now, but they were also very big fare in the silent era. And Nosferatu in 1922 was the product of a great filmmaker named F.W. Murnau. And Murnau was a kind of a romantic in the heart of this period of this expressionist and cubist filmmaking. He really liked Gothic romances. And Nosferatu is really less of one of these angular, shocking kind of things, and more of a kind of dramatically lit. Shows a lot of influence from chiaroscuro lighting, from artists like Rembrandt, from the Baroque period. And these were artists that Murnau liked a lot. And Nosferatu came from the 19th century plays, Varney the Vampire, and stories like The Vampire that even go back to the later 18th century. There was a very important literary work called The Vampire by a man named John Polidori, who himself had cribbed it and ripped it off from other sources. And he got in trouble for it and got disgraced. But it became a huge show and eventually led to Dracula being written in the late 19th century by Bram Stoker, who was an actor's manager. and then it gets brought to the screen in 1922, but they try to hide the fact that they're really stealing Stoker's Dracula, and everybody making the film gets in trouble, and they try to burn every print. So we're lucky we have anything left to see of Nosferatu, which is a great vampire film.
Well, Dr. Soren, can you share with us a pick from the silent movie era that you think is worthy of a watch today?
I'd like for people to become aware of the quasi-silent film. This is the period of transition, 1928, 29, 30, even into 31, where a lot of the films are, they're not silent, but they're quiet. They use actual sound and sound recording, but they have long passages of what Alfred Hitchcock, who was trained in the silent film and grew up in German horror films, this is what Hitchcock called pure cinema. Think of the shower scene in Psycho. That's very much in the tradition of silent film, pure cinema horror from Germany. So The Lodger is a good example of it. Blackmail is a really scary, paranoid film. I highly recommend it. Started as a silent film, and then it has some talking sequences in it. But it's a fabulous example of Hitchcock's pure cinema approach, and it's very, very much in the silent tradition. And another one is a Danish film called Vampyr, V-A-M-P-Y-R, which is essential viewing. I know a lot of your younger listeners are all hooked on vampires at the moment because vampires are really hot. And instead of going to see really crappy new vampire movies like Van Helsing, I hate this movie so much. I can't bring myself to think about it. It's like a bad video game. It's just the worst movie. Vampyr is a film by Carl Dreyer, who was an art film director. And it's his version of Dracula. And he has a tremendous scene in it with a 360-degree camera pan. And the basic idea is that a person has been induced to donate blood, and he's giving blood. And as he's giving blood, he begins to realize that the person who's extracting the blood from him has him strapped down and is actually a vampire and is going to take all of his blood. And the camera slowly pans around the room as he realizes this, extremely slowly. I love this scene. It's one of my favorite scenes in any horror movie. There are a lot of silence at Universal that you should check out. London After Midnight with Lon Chaney. Terrific early vampire film. Remake Mark of the Vampire, also wonderful. Loopy, doesn't make any sense, but full of really fun effects and lots of goofy flapping bats. And while we're on the subject, I was so glad sound came in because I adore Fay Wray, a film that's recently surfaced from 1932, not one of these talkies that isn't very well known, but it's directed by another great horror film director that nobody knows, named Roy William Neal. He did all those Sherlock Holmes films, and he did wonderful early horror movies like The Black Room with Boris Karloff, and he did one called Black Moon, which is, to my knowledge, the first voodoo movie. The last part of Black Moon is way off the wall and off the charts. So Roy William Neal, Fay Wray, Black Moon, very early talkie with long, pure cinema, silent voodoo passages. Oh, I just curl up in a ball and purr at that point.
As we'll hear next, Fay Wray made a big impression not just on Dr. Soren, but also on two brothers from Binghamton, New York. Their names were Rob and Rod, and their last name was Serling, a name now synonymous with television's most successful exploration into the theater of the imagination, The Twilight Zone. This year marks the 50th anniversary of its debut, and Mark Andrews took the opportunity to speak with Tucson resident Robert Serling about the origins of his brother's unforgettable legacy.
This is one of the out-of-the-way places, the unvisited places. Bleak, wasted dying.
The Twilight Zone is a part of popular culture. For many people, they can't even remember when they first became aware of it. Maybe a friend turned them on to it. Or maybe their innate attraction to the bizarre just led them to the show. But imagine seeing The Twilight Zone from the inside out. One Tucson man did. Robert Serling is the older brother of Twilight Zone creator Ron Serling. He says he saw firsthand some of his brother's creative processes, ideas that would go on to become
The Twilight Zone.
Rod told me once that Twilight Zone originated from insomnia. He'd lie awake at night, and he'd think up these plots. And the idea for Twilight Zone came from that. A lot of people, including Rod himself, can't remember where the phrase Twilight Zone began. Rod told me once that he thought it referred to the twilight sleep that women go through before childbirth. Rod thought maybe that's where it came from. Now, of course, it's in dictionaries.
You're traveling through another dimension, a dimension not only of sight and sound, but of mind, a journey into a wondrous land whose boundaries are that of imagination. That's the signpost up ahead. Your next stop, The Twilight Zone.
The Serling brothers collaborated only once on a script for The Twilight Zone episode, The Odyssey of Flight 33, which aired in 1961. Bob says he watched his brother get the idea for the episode from a simple airline brochure. Rod asked Bob what he thought of the idea of an airliner flying from London to New York, suddenly traveling back in time.
He said, "What do you think of that idea?" I said, "You're nuts." "It's a great idea." He said, "Yeah, but it's going to be a Twilight Zone." I go back to Washington, and I get a call from him. "Bob, do you remember that idea I had for a jet that goes back in time?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "I need the cockpit dialogue." I said, "You need the what?" He says, "I need the cockpit dialogue. It's a Twilight Zone."
"Idlewild, this is Global 33. Idlewild, do you read us?" "No soap. Can't raise anyone."
And it turned out to be one of the most successful episodes at all. And it was a terrific episode. One of the best. That was the only connection I ever had with Twilight Zone. Except I was a fan, too.
Bob Serling has lots of fond memories of his brother. He says as adults, the two loved to watch science fiction movies together, particularly one classic of the genre.
The original King Kong. The two of us literally loved that movie. We were at his cottage in New York State. We were in a living room watching for the umpteenth time King Kong. And came the scene where Kong is shot off the top of the Empire State Building and puts Fay Wray down to safety and then lets go and falls to his death. And my late wife came in. There was Rod and there were Bob on the floor sobbing because King Kong just got killed. We were rank sentimentalists and rank romanticists, both of us.
That's Tucson resident Robert Serling remembering his brother, Twilight Zone creator Rod Serling, and giving us a unique perspective into the mind behind The Twilight Zone. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Mark Andrews.
And now, before we close the coffin lid, Arizona Spotlight presents this reading from Tucson novelist Lydia Millett.
The humid air of the streets was heavy with a gray smog. Cars here still ran on leaded gasoline. Simply, no one had yet passed a law to prevent it. As a result, children breathed in the toxic fumes every day and gradually lost brain function. It came to Hal, a curious thought, because he wasn't given to theories of the supernatural, that their ghosts must linger here, the ghosts of those children, before they were impaired. Even as the living children went on, growing into adults of limited intelligence, so must the ghosts linger beside them, pale images of what they might have become. Ahead of him, a thin boy stepped out of the darkened doorway of a building. Hal felt an impulse to apologize to this boy, in case he was one of the retarded ones. Not that Hal himself was personally responsible for the lead in the gasoline of this foreign country, but in the sense that they all were, that individuals were culpable, especially individuals like him, secure and comfortable and well-educated, for all the rest of them. But now the boy must be confused, because he wasn't moving out of the way. Hal would have to step around him, down over the curb, onto the street, and up again. He moved to step into the street, smiling apologetically, in case, since, after all, he was the interloper here, not the boy, it had been rude on his part not to do so in the first place. He noticed, in the boy's rising hand, something thin and gray. Then the boy stepped up to him, and the boy's hand was on his pocket. At the same time, he felt a pain in his side and was already on his way down to the dirty sidewalk before he could say anything. Falling into sharpness, or the sharpness was crumpling him. It happened so smoothly that as the boy ran away, a small bundle in his hand, a wallet, Hal was still feeling beholden, as though he owed him an apology. He was a child, after all. He wanted to protect them, despite the bad behavior, knowing that all hurt animals had to flail. It was bad. It was surprisingly bad. But the sharpness faded, actually washed itself out a bit. It softened and covered him as he lay, doubtful, stricken by confusion. Was he supposed to be doing something? Was there something he could do about his situation? He was part of the world's momentum, part of its on and on functioning, its inertia that was never ending. He himself was responsible for the boy, and by extension for this, for the sharpness and the spreading bewilderment. He had played by the rules. He had always played by the rules, even when, for a second, he considered breaking them and then decided not to. His life had been bracketed by rules, enclosed by their tidy parentheses. He had gone along in the forward motion. He had done nothing to stop it. Warmth flowed over the sidewalk. His own, he felt, in a wave of dismay. Had he disgraced himself? But it was thick, blood, not urine. The sidewalk heated under his side and his arm, but he himself grew colder despite the weather, his legs and stomach icy. He had thought it was so cloying in this place, so humid, just a minute ago. How quickly it all flickered. Time was not in step with humans, in the end. It went too fast and too slow, and yet people expected it to guide them and shelter them. And the boy was gone. Hal was alone, and he almost missed him. Come back, he thought. Boy? Anyone?
That was Lydia Millett, reading an excerpt from her future novel, Ghost Lights. Thank you for listening to this haunted Halloween edition of Arizona Spotlight. This show is a production of KUAZ Radio, Arizona Public Media. Have a safe but extremely scary Halloween.